Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Go to Dutch.com to get vet care that is always there for just $92 a year.
The idea essentially was that to know yourself naked is to become aware of your vulnerability, your physical boundaries in time and space, and your fundamental physiological insufficiencies as they might be judged by others. So there's biological insufficiency that's sort of built into you because you're a fragile, mortal, vulnerable, half-insane creature, and that's just an existential truth. And then, of course, even merely as a human being, even with all those faults, there are faults that you have that are particular to you that might be judged harshly by the group. Well, might be, will definitely be judged harshly by the group. And so to become aware of your nakedness is to become self-conscious and to know your limits and to know your vulnerability. And that's what is revealed to Ham when he comes across his father naked. And so the question is, what does it mean to see your father naked? And it seems to me, and especially in an inappropriate manner like this, it's as if Ham, he does the same thing that happens in the Mesopotamian creation myth when Tiamat and Apsu give rise to the first gods. They're the father of the eventual deity of redemption, Marduk. They're very careless and noisy, and they kill Apsu, their father, and attempt to inhabit his corpse, and that makes Tiamat enraged, and so she bursts forth from the darkness to do them in. It's like a precursor to the flood story, or an analog to the flood story. And I see the same thing happening here with Ham, is that he's insufficiently respectful of his father. And the question is, exactly what does the father represent? And you could say, well, there's the father that you have, and that's a human being, that's a man like other men, a man among men, but then there's the father as such, and that's the spirit of the father. And insofar as you have a father, you have both at the same time. You have the personal father that's a man among other men, just like anyone else's father. But insofar as that man is your father, that means that he's something different than just another person. And what he is the incarnation of the spirit of the father. And to see that, to take it to what? To disrespect that carelessly. Maybe even, like, Noah makes a mistake, right? He produces wine and gets himself drunk. And you might say, well, you know, if he's sprawled out there for everyone to see, it's hardly Ham's fault if he stumbles across him. But the book is laying out a danger. And the danger is that, well, maybe you catch your father at his most vulnerable moment. And if you're disrespectful, then you transgress against the spirit of the father. And if you transgress against the spirit of father and lose spirit of the father and lose respect for the spirit of the father, then that is likely to transform you into a slave. That's a very interesting idea. And I think it's particularly interesting, maybe not particularly interesting, but it's particularly germane, I think, to our current cultural situation, because I think that we're pushed constantly to see the nakedness of our father, so to speak, because of the intense criticism that's directed towards our culture and the patriarchal culture, so to speak. We're constantly exposing its weaknesses and vulnerabilities and, let's say, nakedness. And there's nothing wrong with criticism, but the thing about criticism is the purpose of criticism is to separate the wheat from the chaff. It's not to burn everything to the ground, right? It's to say, well, we're going to carefully look at this. We're going to carefully differentiate. We're going to keep what's good and we're going to move away from what's bad. But the point of the criticism isn't to identify everything as bad. It's to separate what's good from what's bad so that you can retain what's good and move towards it. And And to be careless at that is deadly, because you're inhabited by the spirit of the Father, right? Insofar as you're a cultural construction, which of course is something that the postmodern neo-Marxists are absolutely emphatic about, you're a cultural construction. Insofar as you're a cultural construction, then you're inhabited by the spirit of the Father. And to be disrespectful towards that means to undermine the very structure that makes you not all of what you are, certainly not all of what you are, but a good portion of what you are, insofar as you're a socialized cultural entity. And if you pull out the foundation out from underneath that, what do you have left? You can hardly manage on your own. You know, it's just not possible. You're a cultural creation. And so Ham makes this desperate error and is careless about exposing himself to the vulnerability of his father, something like that. He does it without sufficient respect. And the judgment is that not only will he be a slave, but so will all of his descendants. And he's contrasted with the other two sons who, I suppose, are willing to give their father the benefit of the doubt, something like that. And so when they see him in a compromising position, they handle it with respect and don't capitalize on it. And maybe that makes them strong. That's what it seems to me. And so I think that's what that story means. It has something to do with respect. You know, and the funny thing about having respect for your culture, and I suppose that's partly why I'm doing the biblical stories, is because they're part of my culture. They're part of our culture, perhaps, but they're certainly part of my culture. And it seems to me that it's worthwhile to treat that with respect to see what you can glean from it and not kick it when it's down, let's say. So and so that's how the story of Noah ends. You know, and the thing too is Noah is actually a pretty decent incarnation of the spirit of the Father, which I suppose is one of the things that makes Ham's misstep more egregious, is that, I mean, Noah just built an ark and got everybody through the flood, man, you know? It's not so bad. And so maybe the fact that he happened to drink too much wine one day wasn't enough to justify humiliating him. And, you know, I don't think it's pushing the limits of symbolic interpretation to note on a daily basis that we're all contained in an ark, right? And that's the ark that, you could think about that as the ark that's been bequeathed to us by our forefathers. That's the tremendous infrastructure that we inhabit, that we take for granted, because it works so well, that protects us from things that we can't even imagine, and we don't have to imagine, because we're so well protected. And so one of the things that's really struck me hard, I would say, about the disintegration and corruption of the universities is the absolute ingratitude that goes along with that. You know, criticism, as I said, is a fine thing if it's done in the spirit, in a proper spirit. And that's the spirit of separating the wheat from the chaff. But it needs to be accompanied by gratitude. And it does seem to me that anyone who lives in the West, in the Western culture at this time in history and in this place, and who isn't simultaneously grateful for that is half blind, at least, because it's never been better than this. And it could be so much worse. And it's highly likely that it will be so much worse, because for most of human history, so much worse is the norm. Mother made some pancakes for Billy, but the dragon ate them all. Mother made some more, but the dragon ate those too. Mother kept making pancakes until she ran out of batter. Billy only got one of them, but he said that's all he really wanted anyway. So I'll tell you another story about that. So when I lived in Boston, I had little kids. And my wife took care of some neighborhood little kids because she didn't have a green card. And she was home with the kids anyways. And anyway, she took care of some other little kids. One of them would only eat hot dogs. That was quite funny. He'd only eat hot dogs at his mother's place, but at our house, he ate all of his lunch, and he was perfectly happy about it. So I thought that was quite amusing, too. But anyways, one day, a neighbor came by, and the neighbor had a 4-year-old child. And the neighbor was looking for someone to take care of the child because her nanny had been in a car accident and couldn't take care of the child temporarily. So the child had sort of been circulating around neighborhood houses for a couple of days, and, you know, people were taking care of him. Then he ended up at our house, and which was fine. And so he's a cute little guy. And the mother came to the door, and she said, she's, you know, pushed the boy in, and he was kind of like this. He wasn't very happy. And she said, he probably won't eat all day, but that's okay. And I thought, that's a remarkably interesting statement to, you know, to put forth as a proposition the first time we meet your son. It's like, he won't eat all day, which, by the way, is not okay. It's not okay. And you're going to tell us that it's okay. And you're going to expect that we're just going to accept the fact that you think it's okay. And that's the whole story. You deliver all that information in one little sentence. So I thought, well, that's pretty damn peculiar. I believe she was a psychologist too, which was quite interesting. So, okay, so that's fine. So I went out to do something, and there was four kids playing in the house. And when I came back, the little guy was in the porch, like where the boots were and everything. And he was sort of standing there like this. And I thought, that's not good, because there's all these other kids. Like, he should have been in there playing, eh? That obviously, that's what a child is primed to do. He should have been in there messing about with, I think there was a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old and another 4-year-old. He should have been in there, you know, causing trouble and having fun and playing. But he wasn't. He was standing in the porch like this, and he wasn't happy. He wasn't happy. So I looked at him for a bit, and then I poked him a couple of times, because I thought, you know, if you're interacting with little kids, they're very playful, eh? They're kind of like puppies. And so if you tease them a bit and tickle them a bit, then usually, even if they're crabby, you know, a smile will break out despite their best efforts, and then they'll sort of giggle, and maybe, you know, they'll try to whack you away. And they, you know, they go into a play routine. And although you may not know it, mammals like us have a play circuit. You know, so we're intrinsically playful, which is partly why we can get along with dogs, because, of course, dogs are intrinsically playful, and most people know how to play with a dog. And you know when a dog wants to play, right? Because it sort of puts its paws down and looks up at you and sort of grins and puts its tail in the air and goes like this. It's like, clue in, primate. You know, it's time to engage in some playing. And, you know, you basically know how to do that. And even the dog knows how to do that. So I'm poking this kid and trying to get him to smile, but there's no damn way, you know. I'm poking him. He's just ignoring me like mad. And I thought, that's not good, you know, because you don't want your 4-year-old to have learned that you should, that it's okay to ignore adults, or that you should ignore adults, or that you can ignore adults. That's all bad, because the world's full of adults, and they know a lot of things, and they control all the resources. And so you better get along with them. Plus, you're going to end up as an adult for most of your life. So if the general, you know, if the first rule is adults can and should be ignored, then what the hell are you headed for, you know? And it's one of the reasons that it's really useful to make sure that children respect adults, because they're going to be adults. So if they don't respect adults, then of course they don't have any respect for what they're going to be. Why the hell grow up? You end up like Peter Pan, because that's what Peter Pan's about, right? Peter Pan.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Go to Dutch.com to get vet care that is always there for just $92 a year.
And wants to stay in Neverland with the lost boys, where there's no responsibility, because, you know, he looks at the future and all he sees is Captain Hook, a tyrant who's afraid of death. That's the crocodile, right? That's chasing him with the clock in his stomach. And it's the same thing as this dragon. So, you know, kids have to respect adults. You're doing them a disservice if they don't. So, okay, so fine, I'm poking this kid. There's just no damn way. I'm not getting anywhere with him. And I thought, this isn't good. There's something deeply wrong with this little kid. So that's fine. So then we sit all the kids down for lunch. And the rule is, eat your damn lunch and be thankful for it. Because you think about this. Leonard Cohen wrote this song once about, I don't remember the song particularly, but he talked about the homicidal bitching that goes down in every kitchen about who's going to serve and who's going to eat. It's like, if you haven't encountered that, then there's something terribly wrong, you know. So, because a lot of the tension in households is domestic tension, the tension between husbands and wives, say, or husbands, wives, and children. It's like, just who the hell's going to do the domestic duties, and how, and when? And the answer can't be, well, we're not going to do them, because then, you know, you eat Cheetos and popcorn, and, you know, for the rest of your life, and that's not good. It's got to the point in England, because the domestic situations have deteriorated, the rituals have deteriorated to such a point that about one-third of families no longer have a dining room table. And you can buy pre-cooked hard-boiled eggs. Yeah, right. You know, it's not a good thing. And you might ask yourself, why the hell everyone is either fat or has an eating disorder? And, you know, part of the reason is that the entire domestic routine around regulating food intake has disappeared. That's a terrible thing for people because we're social eaters. So you might say, well, if you sit down with a bunch of other people at a table, how much should you eat? And the answer is, you should eat on average what everyone else eats. And that's exactly what you do, even if you don't notice it. You know, people are so wired into, we did experiments like this. If you bring undergraduates who don't know each other into a lab, and you give them a snack while they're doing something, like watching a movie, they will eat the same number of chips. So, you know, if one of them eats the whole half the thing, the other will eat half. If one only has one, the other will only have one. The correlation between the food intake between the dyads was about 0.8. It was staggering. It seemed to be a little higher for extroverts than for introverts, but it was remarkably, remarkably concordant. And you can understand why, right? Because human beings share food. It's like, you are not going to be a popular tribes person if you eat, you know, 30% of the food when food is in short supply. You better be bloody awake and make sure that you don't take more than your share. And, you know, it's a fundamental element of human nature to do that. And, you know, and we also regulate our sense of satiety by cues that are external to us. So regulating our food intake, also because we're omnivores, turns out to be a tremendously difficult thing. And, well, anyways, back to this kid. So we bring all the kids to the table, and they're sitting around, and they're having lunch. And the rule is, as I said, eat what is in front of you, and be pleased and happy about it. So you might say, well, why would that also be a rule? It's like, okay, put yourself in this position. Now, because you'll be in this position, you're going to cook your damn kid some lunch. And you're going to do that, well, let's calculate it out, because I like doing arithmetic. So let's say it takes you half an hour a day, and you do it 7 days a week. But we'll multiply that by three, because there's three meals. So it's an hour and a half a day, right? So, okay, fine. Seven times an hour and a half is roughly 10. So it's 10 hours a week, it's 40 hours a month, right? 40 hours a month is a full work week. So 40 hours a month times 12. 12 full work weeks, right? Yes? That's three full months of 40-hour days of cooking something for your damn kid. Now, that's a lot of time, and then you're going to do that for 18 years. So then you might ask yourself, what sort of response do you need from your child in order to not feel resentful and miserable about the fact that you have to do that for three bloody months this year? You know, you just have to think about this. And this is also why it's necessary to know that inside yourself, you carry a monster, just like the world outside you carries a monster. Do not think that you're going to be able to maintain a healthy attitude towards your child or towards food or towards yourself if all you can muster up for the effort of cooking and preparing food is the attitude of a slave and continual punishment from the people that you're offering food to. It's like, who the hell wants that? So you want to teach the miserable little blighter that he's lucky that there's any food there at all, and that the proper attitude is to say, really, thank you very much, Mom, or thank you very much, Dad. I'm glad that you produced something. And then, you know, you can be all happy about the fact that you were, you know, slaving away in the kitchen, and you can like your kid. So, and you know, you might think, well, everybody likes their kids. It's like, yeah, right. No, that's not true. That's not true. And now and then, you know, you read in the newspaper about someone who's, you know, being pushed a little bit too far on some day that they're unemployed and hungover and, you know, their relationship is just broken up and they do something absolutely brutal to their child. And you think, well, how could anyone do that? It's like there's a lot of history of terrible interactions between the mother and the child or the father and the child before something like that happens. So, you know, if you want to protect your child against the beast that's inside you, you might want to teach them to treat you with some respect so that you're much more likely to be a civilized human being around them. So, all right, so anyway, so this kid's sitting there, and there's no damn way he's going to eat anything, eh? So we decide we're going to feed him, which I'm an expert at, because my son, the one who said no all the time, he was the most stubborn little cuss you could possibly imagine. And one time when he was about 9 months old, he got a hold of the spoon, and it was like he was not going to be fed anymore, eh? So that's fine, good, you know, it's like feed yourself. But no, kids, eh, they're too damn curious and playful, really, to feed themselves. So you sit them in a high chair, and then, you know, they fling the food onto the floor because that's pretty cool. They can watch that over and over, you know, or they mess around with it, or maybe they, you know, put some in mom's hair because that's interesting too. They have two or three bites, and then they're not ravenous, and then they're much more interested in playing. And that's fine, except that if the kid doesn't eat, then it gets crabby and, you know, whiny and miserable, and then it disturbs the mother or the father, and then it won't sleep at night. It's like, that's no good. So after about 3 days of that, I took the spoon back from him. And he was not happy about that, man. Trying to get that little kid to eat, once I got the spoon, it was like a four-hour battle. It was really remarkable. So I had a lot of respect for his ability just to withstand stubbornness, you know. But I'd learned by that time as a parent that, like, if you want to discipline your child, there's an attitude you have to take, which is, I am going to win this. Like, I don't care how stubborn you are, I am going to win. And because I know I'm going to win, I'm not going to get angry. I'm just going to out-stubborn you. And so, so I'd take up some food and put it in front of him. He'd go like this. So that was a good trick. And so I'd try to get the food in there, and his teeth were gritted. So I'd poke him, you know, poke, 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 poke. And after about 10 pokes, he'd get annoyed and go, ah, and I'd put the food in. And then he'd try to spit it out, so I'd hold it in. And so then, so that was like 3 minutes, you know, and then we did it with another spoonful. And, you know, after about, I'd say an hour of this, my wife had to leave because it was like she just couldn't handle it. And about an hour after this, he decided that, you know, it was okay and that he would let me feed him. But, like, it was brutal. And it was amazing. I mean, little kids are so damn tough, you know, they're really cute and everything, but they're so tough, you just can't believe it. So anyways, so we had this kid at the table, and he was not going to eat. So my wife, who'd learned these tricks by this time, decided to feed him, and he had a lot of sort of 9-month-old or 8-month-old behaviors, because, you know, kids have different strategies of resistance if they don't want to do something, and those strategies get more sophisticated as they get older. And he had some strategies, but they weren't sophisticated, you know. Like, he didn't make jokes or knock the spoon away or get angry or run away or any of those things. He did kind of 9-month-old things, which means he just put his head down, and when she put the spoon towards him, he'd just avert his head one way or another. So that was interesting, because I knew that his parents had given up feeding him when he was about 8 or 9 months old, because those tricks worked, and so that's why she could come to the house and say, he probably won't eat all day, but that's all right, which it isn't. It's not all right. So, fine. So my wife is trying to feed him, and he doesn't open his mouth, so she pokes him a bit, and sooner or later he gets mad and, you know, goes, ah, and she puts the food in, and she does, and then she pats him on the head as soon as he swallows it and says, look, you're being a really good kid, you know, you're doing a good job. And then, so he's wondering what the hell's going on. And then it was so interesting, because she kept feeding him and he was still doing this, but as she patted him on the head, he'd be doing this and he'd open his mouth. So it was like there was this weird conflict between his habitual behavior and this thing that was being reinforced. So then she'd, you know, put the food in and pat him, and he'd, you know, he'd be kind of happy about that, and then he'd go back to his routine. And then she did that for, I think, about 20 minutes. It wasn't disruptive, like all the other kids ate. They didn't even really notice what was going on. It wasn't a big deal, you know. But I was watching, because I knew something was up, because the stupid thing that his mother said, and then the fact that he wouldn't play. And he ignored me. I thought, nah, there's something really not good here. There's a dragon here, and it's a big one. So
she feeds him, and then he finishes the whole bowl. It's like, and she says, "You're a good boy, you ate the whole bowl." And Jesus, you should have seen what happened to that kid, man. It just about broke my heart. Like, really? Like, his eyes got big, and he smiled, and he was just like, he was super thrilled because he'd finally accomplished this absolute basic necessity that he hadn't mastered in 4 years. He finally got it right. And you think of all the meals that he went through, either being ignored or failing 3 times a day for like 3 years. Nothing but failure and bad responses. And, you know, he'd internalized all that. He thought he was a bad kid. And then all of a sudden, poof, he figured this out. And, you know, he got a little reward for it. It was like he just lit up. And that whole shell that he had on that he was, like, using to protect himself when he was in the porch, that just melted away. It was like, it was horrifying and amazing at the same time. And then he followed my wife around after that in the house just like a puppy dog. Like, he would not get more than 1 foot away from her. It was unbelievable. And then we went downstairs to watch like a movie with the kids, and she sat on a rocking chair, and he climbed right up on her lap and grabbed her, just like that Harlow monkey grabbed the, you know, the little soft mother instead of the wiry mother. Boop, he was like this, and he was like that for like 2 hours. He wouldn't let her go. So then the mother came home, his mother came home, and she came downstairs, and she looked at what was going on, you know, and this kid was like glommed onto my wife, and she looked at her and she said, "Oh, super mom," and, you know, took her kid and went home. It's like, Jesus, like, if you don't think there's a dragon in that story, man, you're not listening to it. It was not good. And her response at the end was terrible. She should have said, "Well, how'd you get him to eat?" It's like, "And what the hell is he doing, like, hugging you? He never does that to me." No way, man. She wasn't going to let that piece of information in. And it's no wonder, because the dragon in that story was her. And it was something she did not want to admit. And she was willing, perfectly willing, to sacrifice her child to that, to her failure to realize that she could be a dragon. So that meant that the child was the problem. And that's a hell of a thing to do to a four-year-old. So it was not pleasant. It was really not pleasant. In fact, we probably did damage to the child by actually getting him to do something good, eh? Because we opened up him up to the possibility that he could behave properly and be rewarded for that, and that gave him hope. And so you can bloody well be sure that that hope was dispensed with the next day. So, and that's why Billy doesn't get anything to eat.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Go to Dutch.com to get vet care that is always there for just $92 a year.